From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, this is episode 1000 and what we have learned along the way. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas Matters first hit the airwaves on Texas Public Radio on September the 1st, 2000. And each week since, me and Yvette Benavidez, my creative partner and wife, have produced stories, interviews, and commentaries for public radio listeners across Texas. Looking back at the span of years, patterns are revealed about the stories we've covered. There were legislative fights, battles over textbooks and teaching evolution, assaults on voting rights, the rise of charter schools, and lots of questions about what makes Texas, Texas. Is it the history, the music, the food, or something else? We're going to listen to some of the standout archive stories and interviews from our two decades of doing this project. First up, an interview that I think back on often to remind myself about why we do what we do. This is from October 2003, an interview with Molly Ivins.
Oh, the bushwhacked is just never above a bad pun is our motto. I think people who are fans of Bushes should look at this book. It's not actually about George W. Bush. What we do in every chapter is we start with some piece of public policy, usually quite minor, something that went below the media radar, that just got no headlines, got no attention. And then we sort of trace it out and look at its effects on regular, ordinary, everyday folk. And this is, there is obviously a not very subtle didactic purpose here. We're trying to get people to understand how much of their lives are shaped by government and political decisions. Because people, and this is, you know, apart from Bush, he just happens to be the guy who was president while we did this. We hear so many people say, oh, well, I just don't care much about politics. Well, there's nothing I can do. Ah, they're all crooks. And what we're trying to do is show people not only that are their lives shaped, that the warp and woof of their lives are created by political decisions, but that there is a lot they can do about it when it affects them adversely. And many of the stories in the book, I mean, the comedy is, of course, that we didn't find any average, ordinary, everyday Americans. We found absolutely terrific people everywhere we went.
Even though you are in the book really focusing on specific policy changes that have happened since the beginning of the Bush administration, and your book is called Bushwhacked, and you are seen as one of the nation's most poignant critics of George W. Bush, at least one of the most entertaining critics of George W. Bush. Do people react to you in a hostile manner, just sort of a kill the messenger kind of a way, that don't you dare attack the president?
I don't know that it's a peculiar position, maybe in some ways a privileged one. Yes, and particularly since I started book tour, I've had people say to me, well, aren't you just another Bush hater? And I'm in a happy position of being able to say, actually, no, I'm not. I've known him a long time. I've known him since we were in high school. Never knew him well, but I've known him a long time. Think he's a perfectly affable fellow. Watched him closely for 6 years as governor. I mean, this is a guy I know. And I don't hate him. I think as many of his policies are absolutely terrible. I really think they're causing terrible distress to people in the country. But that's not the same thing as hating George W. You know, if you're a grown-up, you can do that. You can look at a politician and think, boy, is his policy bad, without hating that person personally. And it's one of the things that got so ugly and abnormal during the Clinton years, and the Clinton haters were just so out of control. And it certainly serves no purpose for, you know, the other side to go and do likewise to George W. I mean, if we hated it when it was happening to Clinton, why would we replicate it? What is happening is that people's lives are really not going well. Years ago, Jim Hightower and I thought up this deal where instead of the Dow Jones average, which nobody really knows what it means, but it's always taken, you know, always given time on television news and takes up acres in the newspapers, what we really need is the Doug Jones average. That would be Doug Jones, average American. How's old Doug doing? Is he up? Is he down? Well, in part, what our book was going out to check the Doug Jones average. And the news is not good. It's not just the lost job. It's 2.7 million jobs gone, and most of them aren't coming back. It's lost pensions, lost investments, lost savings, lost health insurance. the price of health insurance doubling and tripling. It's lost overtime, lost organizing. I mean, it is across the board. Things are not going well. And I think what you're feeling and seeing, sensing and understanding is this great stirring as people kind of go, you know, this is not good. And they're not angry at George Bush about it, but they're just becoming aware that things are not going well at all.
That interview with Molly Ivins was recorded in 2003. In the 19 years that Texas Matters has been broadcasting, there have been many major stories so significant that there were no other stories to cover at that time, none more so than when the terror attacks happened on September 11, 2001. While the attacks happened in New York, Washington, D.C., and also in a field in Pennsylvania, the impact was felt across the nation and, of course, here in Texas. And I spoke with the then governor, Rick Perry, about the Texas response.
My fellow Texans, this is Governor Rick Perry. Following the tragic events of September the 11th, Texas has stood tall. Across our state, there's been countless examples of generosity and patriotism from Texans who exemplify the spirit of America. Sadly, there's also been isolated instances where people of Middle Eastern descent living in our state have been the victims of anger. Remember that Muslims and Arab Americans who've been living and working in America for years share our grief and our outrage. Among them, fellow Texans who cherish the freedoms, opportunity, and prosperity they've found here. The attacks against our country are not the work of the Islamic faithful, but the work of terrorists, of fanatics, hijacking the name of religion for their campaign of hatred. It's important in these uncertain times that we not let our anger blind us. We're too big a state, too large a country, to give in to senseless and destructive acts of hate. Together we are Texans, and together we are Americans.
Governor Perry, where were you when the attacks happened on September 11th? How did you hear about it?
Just leaving the residence and... My wife and I were both preparing for the day, and she asked me to come in and see what was transpiring on the television. So that was my first exposure to it, approximately 8 o'clock thereabouts on Tuesday morning, September the 11th.
When did official contact or action start happening?
Our emergency management individuals in the Department of Public Safety started relaying us information relative to any preparation for heightened security at the Capitol and other areas in the state of Texas. Immediately after lunch, I asked for a conference call with all of the mayors of the major metropolitan areas in the state of Texas, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, El Paso, Fort Worth, and Austin. We talked at length about the preparation that needed to be made, both short-term and long-term, and all of this was as information was coming to us about the extent of the attack in New York and in Washington and Northern Virginia, and also the aircraft that was down in Pennsylvania. So we were working not necessarily in the dark, but with sketchy information for the first 4 or 5 hours, and then it became apparent that these attacks were going to be limited to the eastern seaboard, and we still maintain a substantial amount of vigilance across the state of Texas, and as we do through today in various and sundry places in this state. The heightened security is still in place in many areas in the state.
How well prepared is Texas to handle an attack like that on the level of the World Trade Center destruction?
Well, obviously we have an enormous amount of resources, some that are in New York today. Our urban search and rescue team is on the ground, at ground zero at the World Trade Center with the ongoing recovery effort there. We have, on a normal year, some substantial disasters in Texas that have prepared the state for some future disasters, be they natural or man-made.
67 rescue workers from Texas faced the scene of the terrorist attack this week. Members of the urban search and rescue team called Texas Task Force 1 left for New York City Monday to help with recovery efforts where the World Trade Center once stood. Dr. Kimball Bennett is the Texas Task Force White Team leader. He spoke to us from his cell phone at Ground Zero.
The team is made up of specialists of all types. We carry 60,000 pounds of specialized equipment. We're here to take apart the pile to help do that. We had over 1,000 applications to be a member of this team. So they are highly, they're the best of the best Texas has to offer in search and rescue and trauma medicine.
What are you expected to do in New York?
Well, we're here to support the New York Fire Department. Our job is to support them in any way they need. And since we have this technical capabilities and we have the dog teams that are specifically trained for to work in this kind of an environment, what we generally do is as they're uncovering debris out there and they find an area that looks like what we call a void, in other words, it might be a little open space, we have a very high-tech gear that we can telescope down into that area, look around, we can hear in there, and so we're able to look in the void. If we see, firstly, hopefully someone's alive, then, we immediately get on the thing of widening the hole up and getting our search teams down in that area to get that victim out. If there's remains or a body in there, then we do what we have to do there in terms of preserving the scene so that we transfer the materials or the body for the DNA purposes.
Those other instances that you mentioned, those were all acts of God, except for Oklahoma.
That's correct. This is the World Trade Center was definitely terrorism, and so in my book, so was the Timothy McVeigh Oklahoma City
right.
thing. Some people say, well, that's terrorism, too. This is terrorism on an America at War scale. So, yes, we've never seen this. But we're trained to handle it. That's the thing. We've been prepared for this.
Does that make it harder to handle on an emotional level?
It's very, very hard in some cases. It just depends on where you go and what you see. A lot of people are used to seeing some type of accidents and stuff of that nature, but nothing like this.
You must have seen the devastation on TV before you arrived in New York. What is it like when you finally get there?
Nothing like the TV picture. You cannot believe in the TV. You get a two-dimensional view. When you get there in three-dimension and you look at it, you just stand there in awe. Your first emotions, at least my first emotions, we're looking at it is just all. I mean, it's just so huge. And the buildings around, the damage they have, some have even shifted today because it's raining, and we're worried about maybe, some of those sliding down even more. So we're worried about safety out there as well. That's a big concern. But my emotions were to the victims and their families. That's the first thing that strikes you. And when you see those Twin Towers, I've been to New York probably three times in the last year and actually had some series of meetings in the World Trade Center. And so I know exactly what those buildings look like when they stand. And when I see them reduced to 80 feet piles, it's just unbelievable. Then you turn around sometimes, maybe get a tear in your eye, and you turn around, and then what do you look at? I did. I looked at the telephone pole, and on the telephone pole was a beautiful family man and his wife and two little boys, and on the sign it said, "My daddy's missing. Please find him." So it's pretty emotional.
It's hard to imagine. We're used to seeing incredible sights on our television screen, but once you finally see it with your own eyes and your other senses are assaulted as well, you realize what an incredible, unbelievable.
You're right, the other senses. There's a sense of smell that's starting in some places, and the sight one. So they're all going 90 miles an hour, and everyone is affected by it. Does that mean they're going down? No, everybody's going through and doing their job, and we've not had one person fall. But one of the other things we do, we've encouraged our team, is to talk to each other. We do. We talk openly about our emotions, and we get them out. And when we come in, we debrief the teams, and everybody kind of talks and gets through that. And that helps us all, I think. And it's not a macho thing at all. This team is a very caring bunch of people that come from the fire and medical services primarily. And they wouldn't be in what they did if they didn't care about people. And we're here. Hopefully we'll find someone alive. If we don't, if we can help families find the bodies of their loved ones or at least the remains for identification so they can start closure if there is such a thing. It helps the family, though. And so what drives us is we're still helping those families. That's why we're here.
Dr. Bennett, thank you for your time. I appreciate it, sir. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. And on this episode 1000, we're listening to some of the big stories from the last two decades. It was in 2005 that Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, which caused the levees to fail and flood the city. Texas sent emergency crews, supplies, medical staff, and also buses, which were used to bring folks stranded at the New Orleans Superdome to San Antonio. I spoke with bus driver Johnny Keith on his way back from New Orleans.
We're taking a load of people down there. We're going to get some rest there in a hotel room in Houston, and then we're going back to New Orleans for, you know, to restage and take out some more people as they need them to move out.
So you've gone from San Antonio to New Orleans.
That's correct. We went down there last night. We stopped a couple of times and, you know, took a little stretch break and got us something to eat because we knew food and things like that were going to be on a short supply once we got there. We arrived down there in Kenner, Louisiana, which is a suburb of New Orleans, about 11:30 last night. And they did not move the buses because they weren't evacuating any people during the night. But about 8 o'clock this morning, they rolled us out of there, and we went downtown under escort and picked up a load of people, and we're taking them to Houston at the Astrodome. And then we're going to get some rest and head back down there.
Now, they've described the scene at the Superdome as descending into chaos, that the people were panicking, trying to get away. Did you experience any of that?
Yes, we did. There were people, of course, all in and out and around the downtown area because they're starting to venture out on their own, wandering and walking up and down the streets. The people around the dome are getting very chaotic because they've been in there now for 2 or 3 days. And there's been no water, electricity, sewage, you know, toilet, and they're just having to bring in food and things that they can pass out to them, and they had quite a few people in there. Not to mention they had to weather out the storm to begin with. And these people are, it's really setting in, and they're really realizing, especially once they get out of the dome and see all the damage, and the water is still sometimes 4 or 6 inches deep or deeper, right in front of the dome. They're really having, they're realizing how bad it really is and seeing the damage as we leave.
How are the people, how are they now? Are they?
When we first picked them up this morning, they were, of course, especially, exceptionally thankful that someone had come to help and appreciate it. As the trip goes on, of course, this has been a pretty long trip because we left there about, and we've been on the road except for a couple of stops to give them a chance to get off the bus and use restroom facilities, and those that have money can buy things. But, of course, at least about half of them have very little, if anything at all, to buy anything with. And so they're really short on being able to buy anything. Fortunately, when we just crossed over into the state of Texas, there at the roadside park on the Texas side, the Red Cross was set up there and had free water and cups of ice and juice and sweet rolls, and it was really nice. I was really, really impressed that just as soon as we crossed into the state line, that the Red Cross was there at the state line passing out some things to get them by until we can get them to Houston where they're going to feed them.
Another hallmark of Texas Matters has been the author and performing artist interviews conducted by Yvette Benavides. In 2014, she spoke with the celebrated songwriter Rodney Crowell about his creative process.
Well, our last discussion, yours and mine, was in 2011, and our subject was China Buried Sidewalks, your memoir about your parents' mm-hmm. marriage and your childhood. And you told me at that time that writing that book had led to your looking at your songwriting through a very different lens, and you were working on Songs for Ken, the album of songs you wrote with Mary Carr. So how, if you think about that process of writing the memoir, how is it different from this process of working every day and writing songs? And then how is it the same?
Well, I would say that, you know, that anyone who's productive in writing books and paragraphs and sentences, they're up working every day. I mean, it just doesn't get done if you're not dedicated and working every day. So writing songs is a lot different than writing sentences. Generally speaking, you know, a word standing on a page is, I mean, it's out there, and you can't overperform on that. If you do, you're going to get busted. Whereas you can use really giant metaphors in song because you've got chord changes and you can bend the words. You have melody to hide, to tuck it in behind. Where, you know, if you look at You Are My Sunshine, My Only Sunshine, that's a great big old metaphor. And, you know, it sounds kind of good in a song, but you stick it on a page with just one person reading it, it's like, hang on, you're going over the top. So, I mean, I learned that, and I learned that songwriting, the metaphor behind songwriting is, or that, you know, informed songwriting is often too big for the page, as they say. But I think your question is, in terms of work and getting things done, I think it's really a very simple thing, and it's probably with any artist, it's, how much dedication do you have? Do you get up every day and go to work? Because this is the only way you're going to really produce.
And is there another memoir in the works?
Oh, I don't know. I'd like to take a swing at it because I'd like to, probably after that book was published, I probably learned more about writing after it was published than maybe even in the process of writing it, because I don't know, you get away from something, you look at it, and the mistakes you made glare at you, nag a little bit so that you learn. Hindsight ain't no good sight, but it's my sight.
Also in Texas Matters, we have investigative audio documentaries that we've produced over the years, from celebrating the state's historic dance halls, exposing problems with concussions in high school football, sex trafficking, remembering the horrors of the Waco State Home for Children, explaining issues on death row. Many of these documentaries on Texas Matters have been recognized with journalism awards, but one in particular sticks with me. It's the story of Sean Yates, who died at the troubled Texas State Supported Living Center in Corpus Christi.
What happened to Sean Yates is something that can happen to really anyone that lives at this facility, any of the 13 facilities. It's something that's extremely unfortunate. It's something that is hard to really fathom, to wrap your mind around when you have that many staff.
And the death of Sean Yates resurfaces one of the worst episodes in the history of the state-supported living centers, the so-called Fight Club, which happened at the Corpus Christi Living Center. For over a year at the center, staff members would entertain themselves by forcing the residents to fight each other. One staffer recorded over 100 fights on his cell phone. The fights are brutal, and the cries of the residents who are being victimized are bone-chilling. Ashley Yates says she only now very recently learned of the Corpus Christi Fight Club while investigating what happened to her brother. It turns out that Sean was living at the Corpus Christi Center at the time, and she thinks he may have been part of the abuse because of strange injuries that he had at the time.
His left ear. He got hit or something because his ear was like 10 times bigger than what it was supposed to be.
but Ashley said her family was never informed by the state about the Fight Club. Over the years, conducting interviews for Texas Matters, you never know who's going to go on to much bigger things. Like in 2001, when I spoke to an upstart named Tito, who was taking a gamble by becoming the first small distillery owner in Texas.
I mean, for a little, you know, kind of a bootlegger moonshine shack out in the Mesquite Woods, you know, we've gotten some pretty good notoriety.
Now, vodka can be made with any organic material.
Correct.
What do you use?
I use corn. I tried just about everything, and I'd ferment up anything. Basically used my buddies as guinea pigs, and then everybody seemed to like the corn the best, so I use corn.
You have to have a license to brew this stuff up.
Correct.
So how hard was it to get that license?
It was really tough. I'm the only legal distiller in the history of Texas. TABC was pretty tough to get through, but the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was really hard. It took a long time just to get, you know, my permit from them, and then it's kind of a chicken and the egg thing. They won't give you a permit until you have a fully built distillery, you know, equipped and ready to go. Of course, it's kind of hard to get financing or raise money, you know, without that permit in hand, because your investors or bankers, whatever, are kind of like, well, you know, how do you know you can get one? So that was the hard part. And then, of course, had to go through the EPA and the Natural Resource Conservation Commission and Air Board, Water Board, County Judge, County Clerk, Department of Health.
So a lot of red tape.
Yeah, I got all these guys, you know.
You had $130,000 in your own personal savings, and then you borrowed $70,000 against 18 credit cards.
Correct.
That's quite a gamble. I mean, if you didn't even know you were able to get it on a store shelf.
You know, I used to run these seismic crews in South America, and the country manager, he had told me at one point that if you can run these seismic crews, you can do anything. This is the most difficult job that there is. And I guess I just took it to heart because I never had any doubt that I'd get a distributor or whatnot. I thought in the beginning, I thought that I would get some investors to put money in it, so I put in all my money. And then when I didn't get any investors, then I was like, well, now what do? You know, I can either just walk away from it and go back to doing a 9-to-5 or see it through. And so I just kind of took the gamble, saw it through, you know, ended up buying like 100 cases of glass and made up 100 cases of vodka and went out and found a distributor, sold it, got paid, went and bought some more glass, more labels, more tops, you know, did it all over again. Basically, kind of what's going on now, except now I've actually started, you know, buying some more equipment and expanding out here, just trying to get my production rates up so I can go and bring some more vodka to some different states.
Tito's Vodka now sells about 60 million bottles a year. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters, episode 1000. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening over all of these years, and thanks for your support for public radio. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past episodes of Texas Matters, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Podcast.